the way of salvation for all. And that's really incredible. Thank you so much. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Higher education in America.
Part 1.
American media found a relatively new subject in the middle of 2019. Rivalry between the presidential candidates made every comment an attractive news headline. For example, Republican Donald Trump spoke in favor of the U.S. by immigration reduction and the development of foreign policy. On the other side, Democrat Joe Biden stressed the need for controlling the COVID-19 pandemic and respecting the rights of minorities in the U.S.
The question is, the radical question, left,
will you shut
who is
up,
your,
man.
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on
so
your list?
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
Unprecedented.
He's going to pack the court.
No, not
going to give a list.
We have ended this segment. We're going to move on to the second segment.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it?
Of course, the Democratic Party had another candidate besides Joe Biden. 78-year-old Bernie Sanders was another lesser-known candidate of the Democratic Party, a leftist senator who had different things to say than his rivals. The elderly Bernie Sanders made a strange promise to his supporters just a few days before the internal party debate. In the form of a proposal, he promised to completely forgive student debt. This promise seemed strange, but there was an even stranger issue. Bernie Sanders announced an incredible figure for American student debt. He said that American students owed about $1,600 billion to the U.S. banks. He said that the new generation must not be in debt during the lifetime due to the crime of studying at the university.
This proposal completely eliminates student debt in this country and ends the absurdity of sentencing an entire generation, the millennial generation, to a lifetime of debt for the crime of doing the right thing, and that is going out and getting a higher education.
Bernie Sanders' shocking words were almost familiar to the American audience. Because the U.S. student debt had become a news flash about a month before his speech.
An incredible act of generosity. It is changing the lives of hundreds of students. The commencement speaker at Morehouse College vowing to pay off the student loans of every graduate in the class of 2019 to the tune of $40 million.
This part of the news was related to Robert F. Smith. He's an entrepreneur, billionaire, and former university student at Morehouse College. He was aware of the problems of student loans, so he pledged to pay off $40 million in student loans for Morehouse College class of 2019. He made this statement during the graduation ceremony. Of course, students didn't receive this amount of money, and it was donated to pay off their loans. This amount of money could change the lives of students completely. The matter was related to tens of thousands of dollars in student debt and the future of these students at Morehouse College. If he did not donate that amount of money to pay off the student loan debt, each of his classmates would have to spend the next 25 years paying off their debts to the banks, just like other American students. Robert Smith's decision and the feedback in public showed the importance of student loans. People like Robert Smith and Bernie Sanders wanted to cancel education debt. In those days, Bernie Sanders said that he stood against the laws of capitalism and its rapacity. Everyone knew about the results of such disastrous laws. Few people were aware of their procedure and function.
Why are we punishing millions of people because they chose to get an education? That makes no sense.
The university system in America is more like a black box. Even the people who work inside the university are not properly aware of its conditions. Of course, the only obvious thing is the increasing number of young people entering universities. Young people and their families have to borrow from banks if they have not saved extra money for education. Banks take a financial commitment from students in exchange for paying the tuition fees. This financial commitment is considered in installments of several years. There is also another point. The interest of this amount of money increases day by day, and if students don't get a job, they will have to pay back more. So the figure that Bernie Sanders mentioned in his speech was not so unusual.
There is now more than $1.7 trillion in student loan debt. And this isn't just some sort of, you know, young person millennial issue. This really touches every facet of American lives, both individuals, their communities, our economy, and our country.
Since 2000, every student loan is paid with 30% interest. About half of the students have to either drop out of school or accept the terms of repayment to the banks. In 2012, the average debt of per American graduate was more than $25,000. Regarding students' field of study, there were some strange cases where their debt has exceeded $100,000 over the years. These heavy debts have changed the lives of students and their families. Some families have to take other loans from the banks to compensate their children's loans. Loans taken to pay off another loan. These heavy debts have also affected the lives of graduates. Buying a house, starting a family, and continuing the education seem to be dreams by considering the heavy debts. Of course, this issue is specific to students who have been able to graduate. The shocking statistics of students dropping out or extending their studies show that student loans are devastating. From 2007 to 2013, only 56% of American students graduated from public universities. There are other statistics indicating that as of 2012, 68% of American students failed to graduate within 4 years. In some U.S. states, the situation is even worse. In California, despite a significant number of the best universities in the world, it took more than 4 years for 84% of students to graduate. The truth is that the rising cost of living has aggravated the dropout or prolongation of education day by day. For instance, if we compare cost of education, health, and food over 40 years, we understand the new dimensions of this crisis. From 1980 to 2010, the cost of food and health increased by 200 and 600% respectively, but the cost of education has been accompanied by inflation of 1,120%. So American universities must be the worst educational centers in the world and on the verge of closure. But surprisingly, that is not happening. Universities in the United States are questionably famous and popular. In many rankings, 8 of the top 10 universities in the world are American universities. In 2021, Shanghai Ranking announced that for the 19th consecutive year, Harvard University was the best university in the world. Stanford, MIT, Berkeley, Princeton, Columbia, California, and Chicago were other American universities on that list. Their rankings made them to be a model for other scientific centers in the world. According to this institution, the rating criteria can be summarized in several points: the number of Nobel and Fields medals, the number of influential researchers, and the number of scientific articles. Although these criteria place American universities at the top of the list, there are other issues. The question is, how reliable are these ranking lists? These ranking institutes, like Times Higher Education, have a strange and unclear way of work. The strangest institute is QS World University Rankings in the United Kingdom. In QS method, each university can hire people in advance to participate in the survey according to their interests. Money plays an important role in recruitment. It is clear that who receives this amount of money from universities. QS receives money and also gives advice to universities. They help universities to increase their rankings. These are not consultations about teaching style or academic structure, but about cheating in rankings. Behind the QS's list, there is not a reliable research, but an industry. They treat education as a business. QS sells rankings to university presidents, and applicants for the higher education are deceived by the university's reputation and rankings. Of course, cheating is not the only problem in these lists. Some believe that the method of ranking organizations are not professional and therefore unreliable.
When you really scrutinize these rankings and the methods of how they're done, what happens? How are they done?
Well, they're not. It's not a scientific methodology. In fact, the major factor is what all the schools think of each other. So all schools in a particular category, like National University category, they all rank each other on a 1 to 5 scale every year. So, of course, it's absurd. What does somebody at San Diego State know about what's going on at University of Connecticut or University of Missouri, where I went to school? It's a flawed way of evaluating schools.
You mentioned in your book that reputation is very important in the U.S. news ranking. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by reputation?
Well, you know, it's just kind of a general feeling that schools have about the kind of quality of education that's going on at their peer institutions. It's kind of a nebulous thing. Like, how do you measure reputation?
So if Harvard has a great reputation,
right,
or UCLA, that might get a higher percentage.
Yeah, they'll get a 5, right? Everybody's heard of Harvard. Everybody thinks, you know, of UCLA. They're going to give it a very good ranking, just automatically.
Times Higher Education doesn't reveal the information about the locations of participants in the surveys. The qualification of the participants in this survey is also unclear. Shanghai Ranking has another problem as well. This organization ranks universities based on vivid criterion and not the hidden ones. For example, a university that has medical and engineering fields may receive higher rankings. These rankings are based on medals, researchers, and the number of medical and mathematical articles. But what about other fields? It is a bitter joke to evaluate universities' fields of arts and humanities with the fields or Nobel medals. These academic fields are influenced by medical and engineering fields without being present in the rankings. In this way, universities that have medical or engineering fields are always on the top of the list, even if they have a poor performance in other fields.
There's a few different ways that students typically plagiarize. One way is that they completely take a different article, story, something someone else wrote, and they just change the name and turn it in as their own. That's definitely plagiarism, and very intentional. Another intentional way that students plagiarize is that they will take pieces of other articles, maybe from one article or maybe from multiple different articles or books, and they'll patch them together and maybe have a transition sentence or two in between, but it's mostly someone else's work. And again, that's obviously an example of plagiarism.
Perhaps the most important criterion for ranking is article production. But it is better to ask under what process these articles are written. Academic plagiarism by students is the first challenge. In this case, students ask illegal institutes to provide them with an article instead of writing it themselves. In short, articles that are the main ranking criteria are only purchased and not produced, but not everything is related to cheating. The academic publishing industry is more influential than academic cheating. The academic publishing industry is a huge business with an annual revenue of £19 billion. It's very simple. Students and scientists must write academic papers to gain academic credit and develop their work, but these papers are valid only when they are published. Students send their articles to academic journals for free, but their goal is not only the development of science. The managers of these academic journals sell the work of the article writers to others. Customers of scientific journals are governments and public libraries. Libraries of scientific centers and research institutes are the next customers of these articles. This strange cycle apparently has scientific goals, but is like a production line. It does not matter what is written and produced. What is important is to earn money from these writings. Universities need to produce articles to improve rankings, and these articles must be published. Scientific journals have already realized these essentials. So the secret behind the fame and popularity of some universities is revealed. These scientific centers had a different performance many years ago.
Certain economic truths have become self-evident. Among these, the right to a good education.
Right after the Second World War, the GI Bill was passed, which made it possible for men who would never have been allowed to walk onto a college campus except perhaps as members of the custodial staff or as delivery boys to actually walk through the gates as students.
Over 2 million veterans took advantage of the GI Bill. This was an opportunity that was free, given by the government, and it made a difference to the American middle class.
That expansion of the franchise of higher education was really so unprecedented, and it led directly to the Higher Education Act of 1965, creating the federal student aid programs.
This law means that a high school senior can apply to any college and not be turned away because his family is poor.
Education in America was almost free during the middle years of the 20th century. Students could receive scholarships, and everyone had access to education. Education rules were set in a way that young people experienced a more important stage of life in universities. This stage led to building a bright future. But this bright future soon entered a dark era. The 1960s was marked by protests. Blacks, women, and environmentalists and peace activists started to protest. Continuous demonstrations and extensive social changes gradually worried the politicians. There were civil rights movements, and universities were among the main centers of protests. Pro-government theorists considered these protests a crisis of democracy. In their opinion, there was too much freedom in America. Otherwise, people would not come to the streets. The escalation of protests made monopolistic businesses and capitalist supporters more worried. Of course, the solution was simple. Economic and social theorists considered the educational system to be the main culprit of these protests. In their opinion, the university had not fulfilled its duty to train obedient people. These theorists had only one suggestion to solve the problem: crashing the educational system through the economy. If the students were involved in lifelong debt to the banks, they would not have a chance to protest. They believed that by removing the economic security from the people, the security of the politicians will be fully ensured. Accordingly, the university system in the US gradually changed. Under the pretext of rising university costs, free education was forgotten, and students had to pay tuition. In the last 40 years, the number of professors in relation to students has remained constant, but the number of managers and administrative staff has increased in relation to students. On the other hand, the official employment of professors is somehow over. Now, most of the university professors work under a contractual agreement and live in economic insecurity. The current situation is the result of neoliberals in power, like Ronald Reagan.
Conservative governors, especially Governor Reagan of California, had really run on the idea that higher education was a wasteful way to spend taxpayer money. Governor Reagan actually said the state should not subsidize intellectual curiosity. And he ran for president later on a promise to disband the Department of Education.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Bagheri. Stay tuned. There are many fruitful outcomes for paying ziyarat to the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Of course, the path of paying ziyarat to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam might not be an easy one, and even sometimes it may be a dangerous one. However, if someone is really interested in taking steps on this path, he or she must bear its difficulties too. Even it is recommended not to leave this path, even if it is full of dangers, because some special rewards are considered for visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. There are also some special rewards if you go on feet to visit the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This point is mentioned in many authentic narrations of the Shia infallible imams. There are both worldly and otherworldly rewards for visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This is as if all the heaven and earth are serving the pilgrims of the tombs of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and in fact pave the way for the visitors in Karbala. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Bagheri. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned an economic downturn in the United States cannot be ruled out yet. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the economy is still at risk of a recession, while expressing concern over persistently high inflation in the U.S. In an interview with CBS show Face the Nation over the weekend, she said it's appropriate and normal for growth to be low. When asked about a potential recession following the June jobs report, which was the weakest since December 2020, and showed that the U.S. economy was adding fewer jobs than in previous months, Yellen said it's not completely off the table. U.S. inflation has begun to ease. It was still high after prices rose 4% year over year in May, double the U.S. Federal Reserve's 2% target, the Treasury Secretary noted. For months, the Federal Reserve has attempted to restrain inflation by hiking interest rates to their highest level in decades, slowing economic growth and prompting fears of a recession. Last month, the central bank decided not to raise interest rates further, but signaled that more rate hikes this year were possible, saying last week that a recession in 2023 is quite likely, but probably won't be deep or prolonged. According to Forbes, rising interest rates, high inflation, an inverted yield curve, and an unexpected banking crisis have all been cited as reasons that a recession could be imminent in the United States. The New York Fed recession probability indicator suggests there is a 68.2% chance of a U.S. recession sometime in the next 12 months. That's the highest reading in more than four decades. Other reliable economic indicators are flashing warning signs that the U.S. economy could soon be rolling over. The most recent core personal consumption expenditures price index data showed that this key measure of U.S. inflation was up 4.6% from a year ago. While it's down significantly from peak 2022 levels, core PCE remains well above the Fed's long-term target of 2%. That latter point is why the Fed has raised the federal funds target rate range by 5% since March 2022. But while raising rates can help lower inflation, the higher they go, the more expensive it becomes for U.S. companies to invest in innovation and growth. In addition, higher rates increase the cost of loans for regular Americans. Credit card balances, mortgage loans, and auto loans are more expensive, reducing the disposable income people have to spend, weighing on corporate earnings and stock prices. Analysts are expecting S&P 500 companies to report a 6.3% year-over-year earnings decline in the second quarter, the third consecutive quarter of negative earnings growth. The banking crisis in the U.S. has further tightened credit markets, reducing banks' willingness to lend to corporations and consumers. According to Forbes, one warning sign of a U.S. recession has been flashing for investors since mid-2022. The yield on two-year U.S. Treasury notes jumped above the yields on 10-year Treasury notes, a phenomenon known as a yield curve inversion. Inverted yield curves have historically been a strong economic recession indicator. Historically, two-thirds of the time the yield curve has inverted, the U.S. economy has fallen into a recession within 18 months. The last time the yield curve inverted was in late 2019, just a few months prior to the COVID-19 recession. In early 2023, the yield curve inverted to its deepest level since 1981. CNBC also reported it has been well reported that an economic downturn could be coming to the U.S. But the question is, when might a recession happen and how bad could it be? Many Americans fear an economic downturn could be as bad as the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis, a recent nationwide survey of 2,000 adults has found. To that point, 68% are expecting a recession in the next 6 months, and 80% of those respondents expect it to be severe.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences and sorrow and sadness for the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws regarding the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, or in commemoration of his martyrdom, and also Arba'in. Well, before that, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, When the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chowdhury, our guest speaker. We are touching on some of the jurisprudential laws about mourning and Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Chowdhury. Sheikh Chowdhury, if individuals or the public hold ceremonies commemorating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and if two individuals, two non-mahram people, you know, or individuals' bodies, in fact, come in contact with each other during the session, during the procession and rituals, what's the Islamic law about it?
Well, first of all, it's not permissible for men and women to mingle in such a way that they are likely to touch, come into contact with each other physically, because every measure, every action, possible action should be taken to prevent such a mixing of the opposite of the two genders or the two sexes. So women should, of course, women are not, prohibited from taking part in these and the processions or in attending the religious gatherings or in the majalis that are held here and there. So they of course, they like men, they can take part, but they should not mix or mingle with men because there is a chance of one of them getting coming into contact with physical contact with a man, so which is actually forbidden. If it happens accidentally, okay, there's no objection. But if
no one is to blame.
Yeah, no one is to blame, sure.
Yes. Okay, well, is it permissible to borrow money, Sheikh Chowdhury, to hold, for example, the mourning ceremonies or give nadr or go to Karbala? What if the same individual we are talking about, I mean, the person who borrowed the money cannot repay or is unable to repay the money in time?
Well, generally speaking, it's permissible to borrow money, you know, for whatever purpose. There is nothing unlawful or prohibited about borrowing money from other people, no matter what the purpose. So when it comes to holding mourning ceremony, of course there is no problem in doing so and giving nazar and also going to Karbala. But what is necessary, what to be noted in this respect, is that repaying one's loan is a must. It is necessary to repay the money in time. And it is a duty. of the debtor to make every action to repay his loan as soon as he possibly can. And if the time is fixed, he should repay his loan within the fixed time. Mm-hmm. So it's wajib, it is obligatory to do it. But okay, borrowing itself is mustahab. It's not mustahab either. It is allowed, I'm saying. I'm correcting myself.
It's permissible.
It is permissible per se.
Uh-huh. But if the person knows or is certain that cannot return the money, then...
Then, of course, it is actually discouraged, okay? Because he cannot repay it. But, okay, there is a chance, he might actually get a job, earn some money and repay it in the distant future, if not in the near.
I see. Thank you very much, Ajit. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shah Chavid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the mourning related laws or jurisprudential rules based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, over the past 30 years, we've been placing candles, or a couple of decades ago, people used to do that, right? They used to burn candles or place candles in front of the local mosque. There were some places actually cut out for this, or suitable for burning candles there as a sign of grief and lamentation. Well, can we replace the candles with some lamps, for example, or light bulbs or chandeliers, probably,
right,
and give it to the mosques instead of burning candles?
Well, there is nothing in the religious literature to suggest that burning candles or placing candles in front of the mosques is recommended, or it is actually endorsed by the religion. I think, as far as I can understand, it is a religious, it is a cultural issue,
mm-hmm,
rather than a religious advice or religious
or
practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So when it comes to whether it is actually basically permissible or not, of course, the religion does not forbid such a thing because it is considered as a sign of grief and lamentation according to some cultures. So Islam does not intervene in such matters. Okay, there's no objection in expressing your grief in whatever way you would like to, whether it is through burning candles or weeping, crying, beating your chest. So there are different ways of lamenting and showing your grief and sadness and sorrow. So it's okay either way, but it's okay to give lamps to the local mosques instead of burning candles. Sometimes actually burning candles can ignite a fire,
mm-hmm,
and it will have consequences.
Yes, people used to do that like a long time ago.
And they
where
are still
there
doing
was
it.
No electricity. They still do it, I know,
yeah.
But usually what comes to the mind is that in those times we didn't have light or electricity,
yes,
or the power, but now
we do.
Where there is light, then I think it's more logical to like replace it with the light bulb,
sure,
which is much safer.
It
at
is.
The end of the day. There is another question I'd like to ask you before the end of this program, Sheikh Javid, and that is,
Is it okay, is it permissible to trade in houses or do business in houses and cars and sell and buy cars Probably. And houses?
Well, it is okay. It is permissible to buy or engage in dealing with houses, buy property, sell cars, and buy cars during Muharram in Safar, of course. But practically, I think Shia Muslims do avoid, buying property in these 2 months out of respect for Muharram. Of course, there is no disrespect. Even if a person goes ahead and buys, let's say, a house or buys a car or sells or engages in a deal involving a house purchased or sold, see. But the religious authorities have indeed said that it's okay, it's better to to carry out this transaction maybe a few days before the start of Muharram or a few days after the month of Safar to delay it, okay? But it's not haram, okay? If you want to show more respect and if you want to venerate the event of Muharram, it's better not to buy a house or property in these 2 months. Nor sell or such things, okay? It's better to do it earlier or delay it, postpone it for the time after the month of Muharram and Safar.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, in which we try to touch on some of the jurisprudential laws hovering around mourning and azadari and the commemoration of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his noble companions. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received, Hussein plan to retrieve, loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received, Hussein plan to retrieve, loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.